Welcome back, everyone. Jimmy Castillo here with the Knowledge Transfer Group. We're going to do another edition of Agronomy on the Go. We're continuing our crop protection series. I have a couple experts in the room with me today. I have Ted and Rachel, and I will turn it over to them, let them introduce yourself, and then we'll get started on our series today.
Yep. Thanks, Jimmy. This is Rachel Willis. I was on the last one here. I'm a technical agronomist in Northern Illinois, and I have with me Ted Ballard. You want to introduce yourself,
yeah.
Ted?
Yeah. Hey, good afternoon, morning, whoever, whatever time you're listening, guys. My name's Ted Ballard. I'm the technology development reps that covers Northern Illinois. My focus is a little bit more on the crop protection side, but I do play a little bit in the seed and traits as well. So excited to be here and continue this conversation on motive actions.
Thanks, Ted. So the last time we talked, we really focused on mode of action versus site of action and just some really, really quick reviews on crop protection. And this week, I want to talk more about some of those specific site of actions and the herbicide groupings. And so this first one we'll talk about here is the group 27s, and then kind of compare and contrast those with our groups 5 through 7, because in my mind, they both kind of affect chlorophyll a little bit differently. But I think it's easy to group them together and kind of compare and contrast from a site of action standpoint. So we'll start out with our group 27s. These are our HPPD inhibitors. Ted, can you talk a little bit more about the site of action of these herbicides?
Yeah. So when we think about our HPPDs, you know, I think the common phrase that we use with these is our bleachers, right? So how these are going to work is these are going to inhibit the HPPD enzyme. That's the hydroxyphenyl pyruvate digenase enzyme that's going to be found within the plant. So what's going to happen when these are applied, these are disrupting the formation of the carotenoids with the chlorophyll. And so having this destruction of the carotenoids is actually going to cause destruction of chlorophyll molecules by excessive light energy. And that's going to cause that bleaching impact. And so realistically, what we're seeing with this is we're utilizing the power of the sun, if you will, to cause this bleaching impact and cause death within the plant.
Thanks, Ted. So some herbicides are very specific to where they kill broadleaves or they kill grasses, and so you can't use them in those crops. What crops do we use HPPD inhibitors in?
Yeah, so when we think about the crops that we're utilizing HPPDs in here in the Midwest, you know, we're really going to be utilizing these within our corn portfolio. You know, we have a whole vast selection that, you know, we at Bayer have, as well as the competition. So it's a widely used mode of action and site of action that we're taking advantage of. You know, we think about, you know, with these, I know you're probably asking, Rachel, your next question, you know, well, what weed species are we targeting with these? And the nice thing about the HPPDs is we're really able to target both grass species and broadleaf species with this type of chemistry. So it really gives us a nice wide selection. Not all active ingredients are strong on everything. So you'll find that some are a little bit better on broadleafs than grasses, and some are a little bit better on grasses than they are on the broadleaf aspect. But overall, utilizing corn and giving us quite the range of control.
Yeah, I think of these as a pretty foundational group for our corn portfolio. When we think about mostly these being in corn, my mind always goes to carryover concerns. So a lot of acres are corn soybean rotation. Are there carryover concerns? What does that look like?
Yeah, so carryover can become an issue when we think about these group 27s. You know, when we think about the fact that we are utilizing them as a pre, we are utilizing them a lot of times in our post herbicide programs as well. Something to keep in mind, though, again, not all of these group 27s are the same. So you're going to find certain active ingredients. Let's say mesotrione, for instance. Meso has a half-life, if you will, that tends to be a little bit longer than some of our others and can, in dry conditions, get bound up in that soil. And so you'll see that symptomology that next year in a soybean crop, potentially. You'll look at others like tembotrione or isoxaflutol, which do have residual, which do have, you know, somewhat of a half-life. You can see potential carryover if we have loaded the soil with too much of it, but tend to break down maybe a little bit faster than what you might find with on the mesotrione aspect. So there is that concern. We have to be mindful as far as what our herbicide programs are consisting of, so we can hopefully avoid that.
Yeah, thanks, Ted. So I mentioned it once, so we have a few of these in our portfolio. Can you talk a little bit about the group 27s that we have in our portfolio and maybe compare them from a grass or a broadleaf control spectrum? I know you said that they all have something that they're a little bit better on, mm-hmm. maybe a little bit weaker on. Can you talk a little bit about it from a Bayer perspective?
Yeah, when I think about Bayer's portfolio, the group 27s that we think about in our corn programs on the pre and early post side are going to be Trivolt, or, you know, which is a new corn selective herbicide that we have in the tank mix this year. Corvus, been around for a little bit, and Balance Flex as well. And what you'll find with these three, the group 27 that we utilize in this is isoxaflutol. So the nice thing about isoxaflutol is you do get some broadleaf control that comes with this, which is always helpful. You know, we think about problematic weeds. This gives us that opportunity to get those under control early in the season. But where we really shine with the isoxaflutol piece is giving us that aid on the grasses that, you know, can end up becoming an issue later in the season. And so we get that opportunity to get ourselves a little bit of control. The nice thing about isoxaflutol is, as it's been applied, is it gives a chance, as the season goes along, we get some rain and we start to see that break down. And that breaks down into another active ingredient, which is then going to become, gives us a little extended residual activity within that growing season. As we move away from the pre and early post aspect, because what we have to be mindful of with isoxaflutol is we've really only have until V2 to get that group 27 applied. So then we look at our post programs. And when we look at our post programs, we're talking about products in our portfolio like Caprino or Lotus or Diflex Duo. Lotus being the only one that is solely a group 27, that's Timbotrione that's going to be in there. And Timbo is really does a really nice job as far as giving us good residual activity. And, you know, maybe in some situations we can see some decent knockdown, but really when I think about this Timbo and the group 27, you know, we're talking about that residual component. There's other things that we can add to the tank to help with the knockdown and help and really make that better. But overall, with our group 27s, thinking about that residual activity that we have both in these pre-programs that we just mentioned and these post products, you know, it's that residual activity that's helping carry us through.
Yeah. So Ted, when I hear you talk, I've heard you talk before about our portfolio. And one thing you mentioned a little bit about soil half-life and the residual, are there big differences as far as how much activating rainfall we need on some of these? I know that that's, in some cases, that's a really big deal in herbicides. And in other cases, it's not as big of a deal. Is there anything that we need to keep in mind when we think about rainfall?
Yeah, I think when we think about isoxaflutol within those first three products that we mentioned, you know, typically we're talking somewhere between a quarter and a half an inch to make sure that we have activity and activation of that of those AIs within the field. So you know, so yes, it is important to have a little bit of rainfall. There are going to be other group 27s where you don't necessarily need it, but in our portfolio, I think it's pretty important to say, especially on the early aspect.
Thanks for the review on the group 27s. Are there any best practices or watchouts that you want to mention with these before we wrap up our group 27 discussion?
Yeah, I think I just want to reiterate the fact that, you know, we can potentially see carryover from season to season. And so we have to be mindful as far as the fact of when we're building our herbicide programs, there's a lot of group 27s that we utilize. And rightfully so, they really help give us, you know, solid weed control as we move in. I think one thing that we need to be thoughtful of is the environmental conditions in which, you know, we're spraying and we're getting ready to plant. You know, I think we get these herbicides applied. Something to keep in mind besides dry weather is clouds. Cloud cover can also impact the efficacy of these herbicides as well. you know, as we think about that bleaching aspect and really trying to impact the chlorophyll, if there's no sunlight, and as I said at the beginning of this, you know, we're really trying to almost, in a sense, utilize the sun's energy to cause plant death. And so, you know, we can see delay symptomology within these plants that we're targeting if there's a little bit of cloud cover as well. So just because you've sprayed and you're not seeing activity or symptomology doesn't mean that the herbicide isn't working.
Okay, Ted. So we talked a little bit about group 27s and you referred to them as bleachers, and that's how I always think of them. And that's how I really visualize when I'm thinking about symptomology, what it looks like. And they ultimately do impact chlorophyll, which is part of an important part of the photosynthetic process. The other group that I wanted to kind of compare and contrast with is our photosynthesis inhibitors, groups 5, 6, and 7. And we kind of referenced those in our last episode where we talked about site of action versus mode of action. Mode of action would be that it's inhibiting photosynthesis, but then within these groups, there's different specific sites of action for the groups 5, 6, and 7. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit and compare and contrast? They have different sites of action, a little bit different activity. How do they look versus, you know, what you see out of a bleacher, an HPPD chemistry versus these group 5, 6, and 7s?
Yeah, so I think when we look at the group 5, 6, and 7s, you know, we are going to see a little bit of yellowing and, you know, from the chlorosis aspect, which is eventually going to then lead to necrosis. So we will see death. You know, when we think about what's separating these, you know, obviously as you kind of opened up with and talking about comparing these two, we're seeing a lot of impact within the photosynthesis process in the plant. You know, with group 27, what we've essentially done is with the lack of carotenoids in the plant, we've caused a decrease in chlorophyll. And ultimately, that has impacted the photosynthesis process within the plant. With these group 5, 6, and 7s, what we're doing instead is we're inhibiting photosynthesis at the photosystem 2 location. So the 5, 6, and 7s, these are our photosynthesis 2 inhibitors, and there are other products and modes of action, sites of action that impact other photosynthesis sites, but these are focused on site 2. And so what the difference is, though, instead of causing a death in chlorophyll, we're actually doing the opposite here with these products. What we're seeing is we're causing an increase of electrons to accumulate within the chlorophyll molecules. And this is causing that accumulation of chlorophyll molecules, which is leading to oxidation in the excess of what's normally tolerated. And therefore, that's causing the plants to have death. So in one situation with the group 27s, we're removing or killing off that chlorophyll. And here we're actually causing more than the plant can handle, and which is disrupting and causing essentially cell disruption and death of the plant.
Thanks for that explanation. They look a little bit different, but what other differences do we see there? Both, you know, we talked about HPPDs, they can be used mainly in corn. HPPDs, we have some that are mostly pre's, some that are also post's. How about in these photosynthesis inhibitors?
Yeah, so as we look at our photosynthesis inhibitors, you know, I think probably the two most common ones that we're familiar with are atrazine and also going to be metribuzin. Those would be the two that I would highlight. Sure, there's other products like simazine that could be utilized as well in some systems. But atrazine and metribuzin are our most popular. Obviously, when we think about atrazine, we're not utilizing that in a soybean system. We're going to utilize that in our corn systems here in Illinois and in the Midwest. Metribuzin, however, we can utilize in both systems. Predominantly, we're going to see a lot more of metribuzin, I would say, in the soybean side of things, but we can and have that opportunity to utilize it in both programs.
You made the comment that atrazine we don't use in soybeans for several reasons. Are there carryover concerns with atrazine there or even metribuzin, either one?
We can see some carryover, and a lot depends on the soil type with that the crop is getting planted into. pH really has a large impact on these on these products. So if we have poor pH, if we have poor soil conditions, we can see where that might potentially, you know, get carried over. It's not as great of a concern, in my opinion, as compared to the HBPDs. Is it possible? Sure. But the impact on the overall crop, soybeans can tolerate a little bit of atrazine. We'll see some stunting of those plants that have been hit with it, potential death and necrosis. But depending on how far out that atrazine has been applied, you know, we can find ourselves being, you know, being safe as we plant that crop.
Thanks. So, you know, as I think about this group and you look at the list of all of the different herbicides that fall in this group, to me, atrazine is one that we talk a lot about, and it feels like it gets added in to other mixes a lot. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about what it really brings to the table there when it's added in, what additional weeds are controlled when we add that into other mixes?
Yeah. So the nice thing about atrazine is atrazine really gives us a lot of synergy within our tank mixes, and it really helps us to build a strong program that can help target different weed species. And really, as we think about building these programs, and thinking about sites of action as far as where these are hitting within the plant, you know, where, let's say our group 27 is hit, you know, targeting the weed species in this area, that group five or atrazine is going to have the opportunity to hit in a different site. And so we're seeing that synergy. We're seeing these programs really work strongly together. I would never recommend to just come out to your field and just solely apply atrazine. But to come in and partner that up is really good. You know, obviously one of the things that we have to keep in mind is how much we're applying. We are limited on the amount of pounds of atrazine, for instance, that can be applied within the year. And we have those limitations on a lot of products. You know, it's all about following the label. And so, but we look at that, we're going to utilize atrazine in those pre-programs. We're going to utilize it in our post-programs, and that's really what's going to help strengthen and build some strong programs. Atrazine, I think, is also giving us that opportunity, in all reality, to target maybe some weed species that we've kind of overlooked and haven't become an issue, but might start becoming an issue again in certain geographies. We've seen some atrazine reduction in certain areas. And part of that is, you know, the regulatory side of things as well. But, you know, by having that in that tank mix, we're really getting broad spectrum. We get control on our grasses, and we're getting some control on the broadleaves as well. So we do, it's not limited to, you know, monocots or dicots. You know, it really opens up the door to both sides.
Yeah, thanks for that, Ted. Is there anything else that we need to know about these, you know, using these and utilizing them in our crop protection portfolio?
Well, you know, I think, you know, we just spent a lot of time there talking about atrazine, but I think, you know, when we talk about metribuzin, you know, and thinking about how we're going to utilize that in our soybean systems, we want to make sure that metribuzin is on as a pre-emerge a product. Post-emerge, we can see some crop symptomology that does impact our overall plant growth. So that's something that we got to be mindful of. I think one of the things that we also want to talk about and address is symptomology, because obviously we can see these reach out and impact some of a non-target crop, right? And so one of the things that we want to be mindful of as we're scouting and looking with these is, you know, we're going to see some yellowing of the leaf margins and browning of the leaf tips. So we call the browning the necrosis. That's the overall plant death. Something else is we're more likely to see symptomology with these in the older plant leaves than we are the newer plant leaves. So we're not necessarily going to get that translocation through the plant, but it is moving, you know, outside of the roots. And again, I would just want to highlight, you know, high pH soils, those are areas of concern that we need to be mindful of when we're applying these herbicides.
Okay, thanks, Ted. So that's a really good review of group 27 and our group 5, 6, and 7. Both of them impact chlorophyll, but mm-hmm. they do it differently and really add quite a bit of of good options mm-hmm. in our corn with our HPPDs, and then in corn and soybeans with yep. our group 5, 6, and 7s.
Absolutely. Something else I just want to call out real quick too, as I'm sitting here thinking about this, is as well as, you know, I mentioned in the group 27s, we got to be mindful as far as the weather conditions go. And that's important too on that metribuzin piece as well. You know, we will see greater symptomology in cool, wet conditions. And as we think about our growing systems, and as we push for earlier planting dates, we're more likely to see that cool, wet condition as we get into those timeframes. And we need to be able to get those weeds under control. So the likelihood is we will see some symptomology in those cropping systems. And something else to keep in mind is there are some varieties that are going to be a little bit more sensitive to the metribuzin piece than others. So, but overall, yeah, both the group 27s, group 5, 6, and 7s impacting our chlorophyll. One, we're going to be seeing that destruction, that death of the chlorophyll, and impacting how much we have. And the other one's just simply just sitting there and overloading the plant and saying, hey, I've got more than I can handle.
Well, thanks for the review there for us. Also, thanks for the call out on the cool, wet planting conditions with soybeans. We're going to continue to see that a lot, I think, as we plant early. So great reminder. I appreciate your time today, Ted.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks, everybody. And thank you, Rachel and Ted. That's great information. And please stay tuned as we will be bringing more episodes like this to you in the future. Thanks, everybody.